Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisa Kores, the chair of the club's Science and Technology member-led forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Eric Topol. Well, I'm going to introduce you. Eric Topol, MD, is the director of Scripps Translational Science Institute and co-founder and vice chairman of the West Wireless Health Institute in La Jolla, California. He is also a practicing cardiologist at the Scripps Clinic and a professor of genomics at the Scripps Research Institute. As one of the top 10 most cited researchers in medicine, Dr. Topol conducted one of the first trials of a genetically engineered protein for treating heart attacks. He is a leading cardiologist who embraced the study of genomics and the latest advances in technology to treat chronic disease. Dr. Topol's presentation today is based on his new book, The Creative Destruction of Medicine, How the Digital Revolution Will Create a Better Healthcare. Please welcome Dr. Eric Topol.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks very much, and I'm pleased to join you and have this group together, and thanks for coming this evening to hear about new medicine. You can't hear. Okay. I was going to ask about that, so I'm glad you weren't shy. Let's see. I'll make sure. I could. It is working? Okay. Yeah, that should work, I hope. Is that all right now? Great, okay. That way I can be a little mobile and not stand behind something. I never like to do that anyway. So this is a Voltaire quote. You've already had a chance to look at it. That's the medicine of today. I know you're going to think that's kind of rough and harsh, but unfortunately we haven't had the tools to transcend the Voltaire description until now. And so I want to just first justify why the term creative destruction is applicable. We can remember that Joseph Schumpeter, a noted Austrian economist, applied this term and is famous for this term back last century. In fact, he wrote this book in 1911, The Theory of Economic Development. And he basically was very upset about the resistance of change in economy and that the importance of innovation and entrepreneurial activity to change an economy from an old world to a new world. And that's analogous to what we have in medicine today. So with that premise, I just was going to say I am a big fan of Schumpeter and this whole idea of making this into a verb to equate with creative destruction. And I always read The Economist, and the first column I always turn to is Schumpeter, of course. And so last week I had unknowingly looked at the column and said, now for some good news. I said, oh, gee, I wonder what that is. And it was a review of the book. That was really great. And it said, a godsend for those who suffer Armageddon fatigue. So that was very gratifying. Made my day. I mean, it really did. I didn't even know they knew about the book. So what we're going to talk about is how digitizing human beings, which is what the order of the day is for a new medicine, a new precise medicine, can reboot the future of medicine and healthcare. And before I get into it, I want to get a kind of size up the crowd here, the group, is how many of you are on Twitter? Four. Okay. Oh, by maybe a fourth, a fifth, or something like that. That's probably better than I expected. At any rate, I get most of my information through that. So some of the things I'll even present this evening came from that this morning. And I actually think that's the best info. If you're following the right people, you can get great advanced information about things. So that's just part of kind of the sense of the digital world that I'm trying to understand where you're at. The first thing I want to try to prove to you, if you already haven't acknowledged it, is our world has been Schumpeter. That one I think we can get through pretty quickly, but I hope I can get your agreement. Then we will say how medicine will get Schumpetered, and it's ongoing. And then the most potentially the more important aspect of this is in order to do this, we can't rely on the medical community or other forces. We really need the consumers to be the driving force. So let's just start with the digital side of this. The zero zeros were a decade where so much was advanced, and it's actually striking the time compression of how this occurred. So beyond the fact that cell phones are a larger number of cell phones on the planet than there are toilets or toothbrushes. Okay, that's a pretty staggering statistic, and that 90% of the world's population now has access to a mobile signal. So this is an infrastructure that didn't exist until the last decade in particular. And these handheld wireless, these mobile devices, which it's really interesting. So far, I'm looking around. I don't see anybody looking at their mobile device, and I'm really surprised, and I'm wondering how many minutes we're going to go before that happens. But in fact, they changed our whole lives, and I can't imagine they haven't affected each and every one of us here. And we have become, attached to these, surgically connected. And, of course, this happened in a very short period of time. 01 was the music side of this, and then all the way to tablets in 2010. So in the span of less than 9 years, this was a real shakeup. And the point is, if we can shake up that almost everything that we do in our daily lives, why can't we apply that to the medical sphere? This all happened so fast. And, of course, it was consumer-driven. So this is Schumpeter this week, and this is slaves to the smartphone. I think many of us feel that way, and the horrors of hyper-connectivity. But nowadays, it's not even just one screen. We have to look at many screens at once. You know, we have the phone and the tablet and the computer, TV, and this is a new species of man that can be described as Homo distractus. Homo distractus is where we are today. And this is starting up at a very young age. I don't know if you can see this. This Homo distractus is beginning, you know, here. And I thought that was actually very early until I encountered this whole thing. So there's not many digital natives in the room, somewhere at age 30 or 25 or something like that. So all the rest of us have had to learn as we go forward. But I think you'll be able to answer this question pretty easily. But this gives you a kind of sense of how this world changed. What went from zero in 2004 to 800 million by the end of 2011? Facebook, right. So that was pretty striking. How do you get a population that by August will exceed a billion and soon thereafter likely exceed the population of China or India? And because of their likes, this has created an immense valuation. And what is it doing is digitizing you at a very rudimentary level about your likes, affinities, particularly your consumer engagement of what you might buy. And this is the worst scenario, of course. You wake up and you have no Facebook friends. Okay. But these companies, Google, Amazon, Apple, and Facebook, are digitizing us. They're not capable of doing that really in any significant medical health way, but they are certainly acquiring data all the time. And in fact, if you haven't seen this article about the 104 companies besides Google that are tracking you continuously, it's pretty scary stuff because you start to realize that you can't escape this no matter what you do. And then there's this New York Times cover article from a few weeks ago, the magazine, that retail stores like Target know that a woman is pregnant before her family knows, for example. So this cartoon really got to me. This cartoon was how to protect yourself from Google. And when I saw this cartoon, I got sore laughing because of all these things of, like play music loud so they can tell what you're typing and all these protective things. Of course, none of them really work, but it kind of gives you the sense of that we are consciously, we should know that there is this process ongoing. It's not medical yet, but in the times ahead, we'll be able to get data that's medically relevant. Now, this is the other thing that, of course, took off in the same time frame 2 years later, 2006. And it went from zero in 2006 to now 300 million per day, and that is? No, that's way, way beyond that.
Twitter,
right, tweet. So these are then the social networks. The top three are kind of American-based. Obviously, Facebook now has almost one-sixth of the whole planet enrolled in it or more. But these are very country or continent-specific, and they are amassing most of the world's population at this point. Now, why is that important? And that will be, as we finish up here, by having this power of sharing emotions, thoughts, videos, and pictures, that, of course, creates opportunities to bring people together for a common cause like Arab Spring. And this is extremely powerful. What if there was a health spring? Because there is that type of opportunity, and it certainly is something we couldn't have done in the past. Now, this is the first documented case of Facebook saving a life, and it's very interesting. Obviously, Facebook wasn't designed to save any lives, but here was a young boy who was very sick. His mother posted his picture after having been to two pediatricians that couldn't make the diagnosis, and that led to the Kawasaki's diagnosis that appeared to be life-saving for him. And then now there's all these online health communities, and they are extraordinary. And now cumulatively millions of people who have a like condition are finding virtual peers, and they are in a lot of communication with them, and many of them trust their virtual peers more than their doctors. Now, what's really ironical about that is when 4,000 doctors were asked, do you know anything about these patients like me, Cure Together, any of these online, only 11% had ever heard of them. And that was just some months ago. And that just gives you a sense of the chasm between the patient and the doctor community. So this is the stumper. I don't know if anyone will get this. And it was really shocking to me earlier today, especially. But do you know what this picture represents, historically significant in the digital era? This is at the San Diego Zoo. And this is the... There you go. Very good. You know, even the people at Google couldn't get that, and they own YouTube. That was a shock. I couldn't believe it. Anyway, this is the first YouTube video. It's not worth much. It's just I'm at the zoo. But the point is, that was 2005. Okay? That's not even 7 years ago, April 2005. This is the data now for YouTube, and it is mind-blowing. 800 million users, unique users a month, 3 billion views per day, 3 trillion hours of video per month, and 60 hours of new video uploaded every minute. So I don't know what we're doing. We should be either watching, uploading, or doing both right now. We're sitting here without YouTube. I don't know how that's possible. Okay. So cumulatively, what we're talking about is generating a ginormous amount of data. So when you think that there was only a billion gigabytes from the birth of civilization in 2003, and now we're generating zettabytes of trillion gigabytes, at least that much every year. So you got this creation of this humongous data. It's called big data. I don't think that term is adequate. And this big data obviously needs to be worked with and to extract the useful information, just like the whole concept of Moneyball with evaluating baseball players. But we don't have that until we have ways to house, manipulate that data. And that brings us to things like the supercomputer. The Watson supercomputer now has been connected, the dots, with saving lives, although there isn't a documented case. But remember that a supercomputer can read, process 2 million pages in 3 seconds of content. Now, no doctor could even come close to that ability. Of course, many of them believe they can, but actually... they can't. Now, why is this important? Well, wouldn't you like, if you had a really complex situation, wouldn't you like to know all the literature, everything up to the moment? And wouldn't that make sense for all complex cases? Well, the first group that figured that out was WellPoint, this private insurer, large private insurer, and they are contracting for difficult cases to work with Watson. And now there's cancer centers that are also working with Watson. And so this is a hopeful a segue to when this is something that's widely available. The other major piece to finish up on this digital infrastructure, which has changed so much, and without which we couldn't think of a new medicine, is the cloud computing. This is everywhere now. Everywhere you look. In fact, even just last month, UnitedHealth announced that they're having a cloud for all their doctors and patients for all their data, and that's a very positive thing. That's the largest private insurer in the country. And I thought this cloud thing had gone a little too far, so I thought these cartoons might capture it. This one says the check is in the cloud. And this one is, it was much nicer before people stored all their personal information in the cloud. Okay. Now, just to pull this together then, there are this series of things that happened over the last 30 years, like the cell phone, like the personal computer, internet. But really in the last decade, as you can see, things really took off. And you see it isn't just digital devices. We'll talk a little bit about sequencing and obviously social networks, much bigger than was thought. It's cloud and supercomputing. And that sets up this unique moment in our history in terms of getting us ready for this very different form of healthcare. So before turning to that, I just wanted to ask you about books. Obviously, a lot of you still read hard copy books because you come here and you must buy books and you're members of the club. And I don't know that they have a special electronic version for the Commonwealth Club. Maybe they do. Oh, okay, that's interesting. Okay, but how many only read books on an e-reader now? Oh, wow, that's interesting. Okay. Well, what's really interesting is that this is a big day. Okay? Encyclopedia Britannica, 244 years, emanating in the time of Voltaire. All right? 244 years later, now they're not going to print the Encyclopedia Britannica ever again. That's a pretty big thing. Where are we going with books? Well, of course, you know, I don't think anybody knows, although I sure like a real book. But what's interesting is, and this is my last point to have a dramatic impact personally, I did my cardiology training at Johns Hopkins. The second largest medical library in the United States is the Welch Medical Library. This whole building and the library closed January 1st. There is no Welch Medical Library. It's all about digital downloading, and it's closed. And that really, of course, takes me to the hopeful point that we can all agree on, is our world has been schumpetered, if you accept that. If you accept this verb, that is. You've accepted Google, so hopefully you'll accept this one. Okay. Are we all right on that? Any points to before we go on to phase two? Okay, so phase two here is this medical coalescence. Do you know that the medical community has lived in a cocoon? And it hasn't allowed the digital massive infrastructure, which keeps getting better and more extraordinary, it hasn't allowed it in. And it's basically been in these separate orbits. And so when that changes, which is inevitable, it's just a matter of when, it's the last frontier where digital has not really taken hold, that gives us this new capacity to digitize human beings. So you're familiar with digitizing books and periodicals and movies and songs, but we have never been able to digitize the essence of what makes a person the individual, biology, the anatomy, the physiology, until now. So everything in medicine is based on a population level. So when we do screening, everybody is treated the same. When we give a medicine for a diagnosis, they all get the same drug, the same dose, pretty much. And so that's the way medicine is, large clinical trials where a few people per 100 benefit, and then everybody gets the therapy because it was shown to be validated in a large clinical trial. That's completely off base when you can define the individual. And actually, I think one of the most exceptional thinking about this has come from Thomas Goetz, who's here in the front row, not afraid to sit in the front row. And he, beyond the book that he has on decision tree, which many of you have, I'm sure, and have read through it, but this was a cover article in Wired called The Feedback Loop. And basically, that's what this is about. It's a feedback loop to data in medicine that we never had before. For example, continuous blood pressure, continuous glucose, all sorts of metrics, which is not only important for the individual to see that, but also for the physician or the nurse practitioner or whoever is involved in their care. This is an immense new thing which sets up this science of individuality. So I give a lot of credit for Thomas having seen that, and of course he was drawing out from even when you drive and you see your speed is, and how that translates even to how people might take care of themselves and how the medical community may deal with this. this whole movement got started with the health and fitness world, and that was, of course, with like the Nike shoe and these accelerometers. Anybody have used the Fitbit or the Direct Life? One there, a couple. There's the Fuel Band from Nike that just came out. These are really great because they encourage people to move more, get their 10,000 steps a day, which most of us don't get. And so this is something I recommend to patients. Another problem we have is sleeplessness. We're so wired and to our wireless devices and our e-slave life that we have that we don't get much sleep. So this is a device, the Zio, that is the only one of many sleep sensors that actually measures brain waves. And it communicates directly to the phone. All these devices are $99, by the way, the accelerometers, the sleep devices. At any rate, you can also get a clock, a very nice clock that has minute by minute right on the clock your recording, or it's directly on the phone. This is what would look like on your phone or the clock. This is a night of my sleep, and you see the different bars. Orange is the awake time. The gray is light gray is the light sleep isn't worth much. And then the two greens are the good sleep. Light green is the dream, REM sleep. And then the dark green is the deep restorative sleep. So anyway, I was starting out with this to get to be a better sleeper. I try all these sensors before I recommend them to patients. And, of course, what happens, my wife, the night owl, comes in. She looks at the clock. She says, "Eric, I know you're awake, and I want to talk." So I just want to warn you, if you get this thing. By the way, has anybody used the Zio? Probably besides, four or five people? Interesting. So you got to watch out for that, okay? And interestingly, when the Wall Street Journal reviewed the book, that was the one call-out, which was very embarrassing. Okay. Now, the reason I bring this up, again, there's a couple reasons, but this is the prototype of data which you then can compare and have managed competition. So think about this if you're a diabetic and you want to have your glucose control, your blood pressure. There's a free digital infrastructure, social networking, that you now could compete, whether it's your Facebook friends or your Google Plus circles, or in this case, 10,000 people in my age group. I can then compare my sleep quantitatively, every aspect, with those people and try to compete and do better. Okay, and that's free. Just have that data all in aggregate. Now, why is this important? Well, it turns out that athletes are really into sleep now. They've learned that that is something that's not detected from all the drug testing. And so the triathletes and three NBA teams are actually now, they're actually using this every night, because they've been correlating that the higher the ZQ cumulative score, the better their performance is. So I thought this is really interesting. And now there's this craze among the pro athletes of who are the best sleepers. And they've compiled the data, and it's really very interesting. This is a compilation. The king of sleep is LeBron James. He averages 12 hours a night, 12 hours a night of sleep. No wonder if they haven't won the playoffs. And the absolute worst sleeper among all the pros is Tiger Woods, and I'm not going to comment further on that. Yeah, it's true. It's amazing, isn't it? Okay, so now we're going to get into these devices. We talked about sleep and fitness. Now let's get into these wireless devices. They're kind of in the beginning phases. You've got iHealth and Withings that do blood pressure. It makes it fun. You just press a button, start. You get your blood pressure. It graphs it on your phone or your tablet. It sends it to whoever you want. And it stores, archives all the data, the same for glucose. So that's good, but it still requires, you got to push a button. It's still an active thing. But at least you got a lot of data. And my patients like this, particularly the blood pressure, because they don't have to write things down. I get a lot more readings, another $99 thing. You know, that's what all these devices seem to be working at. Well, this is the glucose that has been available for a few years that can measure glucose every 5 minutes. But it requires a separate receiver that's much bigger than this that is not only bulky, but then people with diabetes have to basically say, well, what's that? Well, you know, I have diabetes. I'm checking my glucose. It's not a really good thing. But I wanted to show you because I have a new device. It isn't out yet, but it's really quite impressive. I'm wearing this sensor, like what you see on the picture, and you can wear it on your arm or your abdomen or various places. And I can turn on this phone. It's 6:30, and I can just go turn it on. And my glucose right at this moment is 127. And every minute, I will get my glucose. Now, why is that useful? Besides the fact that I can look at trends and see 3 hours, 12 hours right on the phone, or send it to my diabetologist. We've got an endocrinologist, at least one in the group. But so you might not want to get all these readings frequently. But the reason why it's useful is I'm sitting here, I'm looking at my phone, and I'm looking at this really nice cookie. Do I want to eat the cookie and have my glucose shoot up to 180 or 200, stress out my pancreas, or I'm going to leave it alone, and I've got data I never had before, feedback loop. But now applied to, and it's not only feasible, it's ready to go. All we're waiting for that is the FDA. But then another thing that's really striking is this sensor. This is amazing because it took so, it's so simple. These sensors that get a cardiogram, that's what's pictured here. You have a credit card version that you can put in your wallet or your purse. And you can then take your phone, and I got an iPhone that goes with this one. So you pop the phone in the case, or you can do it without it. You then can turn it on, and get the app up. And what you see, particularly if you're dizzy or lightheaded, you don't know what's going on. So you just put your fingers on the sensor like this, and you have a cardiogram. It's remarkably simple. We're not talking about a heart rate. Anybody can get a heart rate. This is the actual cardiogram. And then you can take this, the case, or you can take this thing here, and you can go on every lead. So you can get all, many of you have had a cardiogram, you know you got to get all the different leads in the chest. And I had not foreseen the application, but I was on a nonstop flight cross country, and then they call for doctor on the plane. And there was a fellow in the last row in the back of the plane, and he was having chest pain. And I had never thought about this, but then I said, oh my gosh, I've got a way to differentiate whether this is indigestion or the real deal heart attack. And he actually was having a significant heart attack, which led to an emergency landing of the plane. And now the interesting thing is it was a great example of readiness. They had an ambulance to take him to a cath lab to open up the artery and restore blood supply to his heart. But while he was getting off the plane and getting settled in the ambulance, the pilots and the flight attendants all wanted to have their cardiogram done, which was really interesting. Okay, they had gone through a stressful experience, as all of us had. Okay, so that's some sensors to give you a feel. These are already in existence today. This cardiogram thing is just about to be approved in Europe and hopefully someday also in the U.S. Then there's Norman Holter's invention of 1949. Some of you have had a Holter monitor your heart rhythm for 24 hours. It is very difficult. You've had it. You got to have all these wires on. You can't exercise. You can't have a shower. You got to go in to hook it up and go back in to get it disconnected. Now there's a little Band-Aid. I've tried it, and I've used it now in patients. Where you put it on the chest. It can stay on for 10 days or 2 weeks. It comes in the mail, and you mail it back. The Netflix of heart rhythm monitoring. So, you know, we're seeing really great progress here, and it's exciting. And then it goes to all vital signs, your blood pressure, your not just your cardiogram, your oxygen, your blood through a wristband to your phone. And so this is what it will look like on your phone. It's technically feasible now. You'll look at your phone, you're looking at your email, the web, and now you're looking at all your vital signs, just like this, in real time. It's all doable now. Now, not most people will not want to have this data because it might drive them cuckoo. And, of course, that term cyberchondria has been equated with this experience. But this is where we are with sensors. And then there's things like being able to take a picture of a skin lesion. If you're a dermatologist, you can see a really big drop down in referrals because a lot of these don't need a biopsy, and they can be processed, an algorithm, to take from the picture. And then there's this one. This is a killer ad, not an app, really. There's an app with it. But this is a $2 device that you pop on the smartphone, and it does your eye refraction, and then it texts it to get your glasses made. $2. So if you're an optometrist, watch out, because you're in the midst of like an Encyclopedia Britannica problem. Okay? So this is now being used worldwide. It was invented by folks at MIT. Not so much in the U.S., but it's getting a lot of use, and it's helping a lot of people see. And then while we're on the subject of the eye, you can monitor glaucoma, eye pressure continuously through a contact lens, go to the phone, and you can measure through the breath. You can digitize a person's breath, and you can tell whether they're going to have an asthma attack, a wheezometer. Or you can even detect whether lung cancer is potentially present, which would be great compared to exposing people to very high radiation scans, expensive things. But what's really interesting is this morning, again, through Twitter, I was alerted to this, that there's now an inhaler which has been gamified, because most people who have asthma, they don't use their inhaler properly. So now they've gamified inhalers. And there's going to be a lot of this gamification of these wireless medical devices. This is one of the early examples. So a lot of times when I ask, what is the icon of innovation? I mean, the answer is actually the light bulb in terms of history. But a lot of people say, oh, it's Apple. Well, that's certainly innovative. And, of course, Steve Jobs, this was the idea that the logo should be morphed. And then, of course, the impact. And if you show this at Google, it doesn't go over very well, okay? But this is, of course, the worldwide impact of but I just thought you would appreciate the cover of New Yorker and this cartoon about Moses meets Steve. He's going to upgrade your tablets. I thought that you might get a sense that there's been an extraordinary amount of impact here. Now, the reason I bring this up is because Steve Jobs, and by the way, you probably have read this book, most of you. It's really worth a read because it takes you through the whole digital era. But as he predicted, and as I totally agree, the next phase, which is equally, if not more exciting, is the quote that he had in the next to last chapter. And that was, I think the biggest innovations of the 21st century will be the intersection of biology and technology. And that's what we're talking about this evening. And he had already figured that out. And I think, you know, we couldn't be in more agreement. This is now the ACTGs. We are all just lots of zero ones and lots of ACTGs. That's us digitized, just billions and billions of these. And so that's from a medical standpoint. Now, we could get the ACTGs, there's 6 billion in a human genome. You have to sequence 40-fold to be accurate. That's a quarter, or 240 a billion pieces of data for each individual. We would get this through currently next-generation sequencing, so-called next-generation, $750,000 for these big platforms, and then a lot more money for the proprietary reagents. Takes 7 to 10 days to do sequencing. Okay? Then came this device in January. It was announced that it could do a sequence of a whole human genome in 2 hours. Okay, so wow, that's a pretty big jump from 7 to 10 days to 2 hours. I said, well, okay, we're good for 2012. Well, then last month this came along, size of a USB device called the MinION, the GridION, and it can sequence a whole human genome in 15 minutes at a cost of $900. So this is an extraordinary development, and it just connects to the laptop, and you get all this data. Hopefully, you've got a lot of a powerful laptop to handle this. Now, why is this so important? You've been hearing about this Human Genome Project since the year 2000. The White House, Clinton, and Francis Collins, Craig Venter. Well, it's finally hitting it big. And the reason I can say that now is we've actually seen people's lives who were saved through sequencing. This is the first case. Are you familiar with Nicholas Volker? Anybody know that story? It's an amazing story. He was won the Pulitzer Prize in reporting a year ago, the Milwaukee Sentinel paper. This is a story whereby this boy at age 5 was desperately ill, thought that he was nearly about to die. He had 100 operations. He was had constant infections. And no one had ever seen anything like this before. So what they did before they completely gave up is the lead pediatrician on the team said, why don't we sequence Nicholas and see if we can find something? And that's what they did. They found the causative mutation. This is the greatest thing about digitizing human beings, root cause analysis. They got that, and that led to a healthy boy, he's now 6 years old. He's cured. And this is a really remarkable story. But it's not an isolated story. And we had our Future of Genomic Medicine course just last week, and we had this family opened up the course. San Diego family, the twins, these teenage twins, Noah and Alexis, had a terrible movement disorder. They couldn't really get around. Alexis had been in the emergency room with breathing problems, serious acute breathing problems. They were sequenced, They not only define the mutation causing this movement disorder, but also the treatment. And they're now perfectly healthy. Noah is a soccer star. Alexis, a track star. Who could have thought that their lives could be changed? And this family has been completely turned around through sequencing. We're in the midst of a project like that called IDIOM, Idiopathic Diseases of Man. And we have enrolled now several individuals like this girl, 15-year-old, brilliant girl, incredibly cheerful, but wheelchair-bound. No one knows what's wrong with her. There's so many of these people that go from medical center to the next. And if you know of anyone who's defied diagnosis through conventional means, you might consider our Scripps project. But the reason I bring this up is idiopathic is a terrible medical term. It's a fancy term for we don't know. Why don't we just say we don't know? We have to have this, you know, really fancy word. We want to get rid of this. Not only is it a bad word, but we have a way to understand these people, so it won't be we don't know. We want to say we do know. Then there's the cancer story, which is unfolding more rapidly than anyone could have forecast. The war on cancer is finally getting into the real time, because, for example, this is an individual who has a PET scan with metastases from melanoma all over. And in this individual, like most of the two-thirds of people with metastatic melanoma, they carry a mutation in a gene called BRAF. And when they get a drug that's directed specifically to that mutation, 85% have a response just like this, in 2 weeks with a pill. And they have no evidence of any cancer. And this is, of course, extraordinary, but it's not isolated to this. In fact, here's another drug that was just approved, same story, basal cell carcinoma, hedgehog gene pathway, and the same thing occurs in kids with this brain tumor called medulloblastoma. 2 weeks of therapy, no evidence. So this is the matching up of the mutation root cause with the drug, and that's what we want. And in fact, that can be extended. And one of the problems we have today, by the way, is that when we have a cancer specimen, and we were talking about that earlier this afternoon, that whenever there's a pathologist or a surgical oncologist taking out cancer, whether it's biopsy or a sample, they drop it in formaldehyde. That essentially ruins it. You can't sequence the genome when it's in formaldehyde. And so that is the ritual of medicine. And we need to get over that. We need to have some of that sample put in frozen form so that we can get rid of this problem and be able to sequence and then lead to these very effective therapies. And while we're on effective therapies, this is a salient example. Cystic fibrosis, the gene was known since 1989. But now we know that specific mutation causing cystic fibrosis is amenable to a drug designed for that mutation, that defect, molecular defect. And girls like this Capri Falk, who couldn't even breathe very well, she's now a real athlete. And this is a real positive step. These are just some graphs to show the striking, eureka response when you match up a drug with a mutation. And now we're not in the cancer space. We're now in a rare but important genetic disorder. And this accounts for kids that their breathing gets normalized and they gain weight. They're thriving again just by being on the right treatment. Now, this is a gruesome picture, but I wanted to help portray and get in your mind about side effects of drugs that can be anticipated if we do a genotype. So this is from the drug Tegretol. I don't know if you've heard of that drug. Commonly used. Tens of thousands of Americans take this, if not 100,000. And this is a drug that's used for various neurologic conditions. But it has a side effect in 1 in 1,000 people, like roulette, Russian roulette, and you can die with this Stevens-Johnson syndrome. Well, what's interesting now is that you can predict that with a genotype. And in Taiwan, you can't get the drug without the genotype. What about in the United States? No, there isn't any genotype, even though we know the gene for the European ancestry. And that's the kind of thing that has to change. I'm trying to get to you that we have the data, the information, the knowledge, but we're not actualizing it in our practice of medicine. And this one is something I wrote about last week, the statins. I know many of you are taking statins because they're nearly in the water supply, okay? Most of you are taking statins because you have a high LDL cholesterol, and it makes your LDL cholesterol look beautiful. You don't have any heart disease. The problem is that only one to two per 100 people who take a statin like that are deriving any benefit. And one in 200 people are getting diabetes from the statin. I'm not talking about people who already have heart disease. I'm talking about people who are preventing ever getting it, and we're overdosing. And the problem is it wasn't recognized in the early time with these weak statins, like was Mevacor, it's called, or Pravacol. They were weak. They didn't do this. But the potent statins like Crestor and Lipitor or high doses of simvastatin, used to be known as Zocor, 40 milligrams or more, they engender diabetes. In fact, if you get to 80 milligrams of Lipitor, you're more than 1 in 50 chance you're going to get diabetes. And that's not offset by any better chance you're going to prevent heart attack. And it's amazing to me that this has continued to go on, and that's why I had there was an FDA advisory about this, finally, but this is something that you should know about. And that was just last week. Now, one other thing about these new tools is new imaging devices. And so new imaging devices like the stethoscope is so old, so obsolete, and it's the icon of medicine. You can't watch any show, House, or whatever you watch for, that's related to medicine, look at an ad. They always have the stethoscope in the pocket or around the neck or something. This thing is obsolete. And why do I say that? Well, if you're listening to the heart, why do you want to listen to Love Dove? Okay? Because you can carry this thing in your pocket. It fits better. It's a portable pocket ultrasound, high-resolution device. We did a study published last year. We showed it works just as well, the resolution, as the $300,000 refrigerator size machine that sits in the Echo Lab where you get the 45-minute ritual full exam. And, by the way, during that exam, you meet up with an ultrasonographer who has great intention but is not allowed to tell you anything about your study. You can have their head cut off. And then you don't even get your study because you have to beg to get the report. And so now you can do this right when the patient's there. While you're sitting there, you take this out instead of the stethoscope. I haven't used a stethoscope in over 2 years. And I can get all this information rapidly in a minute, 2 minutes max. And this shows everything. Why would I listen when I can see it all? So much more information. I'm digitizing the person's heart with them, sharing it with them in real time. They walk out of the physical exam and visit. They know the results. They don't have to wait for the report they're never going to see. And this is an example of a person with a very weak heart to give you the contrast, the very big chambers. The heart muscle is very weak, and this is a whole different look. Now, before I finish on imaging, I had to touch on this very briefly, because if you thought imaging the heart was something, how about reading your mind? That's the scariest thing I've seen. That is really scary stuff. And this is mind-goggling. I think this is mind-blowing, because what this is now we can, you know, the two most complex things about human being from the essence of digitizing are the genome and the brain, the connectome, the four quadrillion synapses that exist in the brain. So now the UC Berkeley has done this study, which I think is amazing. They took people, they put them in a functional magnetic resonance image machine. They showed them YouTube video. And then they, without knowing anything about the video, they did brain activation maps to reconstruct what they were seeing. And so this is the example of their reconstruction. You say, well, you know, it's a little bit off, but this is 2011. And they've just recently published the same sort of thing with auditory, whether it's, you know, music or speeches. And so this is a pretty scary thought that you could wake up in the morning and you could open up your iPad and you could watch your movies of your brain from the night, the dreams of the night before, or worse than that, other people could watch your dreams and could read your mind. So that's imaging. And now, just before getting to this last point, is I just want to say, when you can put these things together, it even gets more powerful, these new tools. So, for example, the thing that kills people the most is heart attacks. And third most is strokes. Both of them share this common crack of the artery wall. Now, the crack of the artery wall, a prototypic example is Tim Russert. He was in the NBC studio, actually in Washington, D.C., he keeled over with a massive heart attack. But you may recall he'd had a stress test, treadmill, 3 weeks before. Perfectly normal. That is the classic story. The stress test only picks up whether or not there's been a problem with the blood supply. Most cracks occur, almost all, where there's not a tight narrowing. So we haven't had a way to get at that. And we need to. And we just have now spent the last few years to discover that we can get the cells that are sloughing off from the artery and can predict a heart attack. We took these cells that in patients with heart attack throughout San Diego. We sequenced the cells. We have a molecular signature. And once you have that, this is compared to healthy controls. Not only is there order of magnitude more cells, but they're totally different looking, you can see. And their genetic signature is very distinct. So we have a paper coming out in a couple of weeks that really describes how this can be used as a predicting heart attack. We've never had this before. And just like your car that has all these sensors, okay, you have sensors for your car. Why don't we have sensors for our body? They're embedded in your car. You don't even know where they are. They just work, and they tell you when you got an engine problem. Well, this chip was publicized from Stanford just a few weeks ago. It's a microchip that can be put in the blood as a sensor with no power requirement. And we have also worked with nanochips, size of a grain of sand. What happens when you have a nanochip connected to a molecular signature for a predictive event? Where does that take you? Well, that circles right back to our wireless world of having a heart attack app where you get a ringtone, tells you in the next week or 10 days, you're going to have a heart attack. You don't want to get the ringtone, but it's a whole lot better than getting the heart attack. And the same sort of thing for cancer cells. That could be done because cancer cells have a distinct molecular signature that can be picked up through a sensor. Similarly, diabetes. Why should we have children who get diabetes age 5, 8, when it takes 5 years to knock off, auto-destroy your pancreas? We should be able to intervene if we have a sensor to know when these attacks are coming. And there's lots of things we can do, hopefully do that and have apps for that. So I've taken you through these two other areas, and I just want to finish up very briefly on this last key point. How are we going to get this done? How are we going to change medicine? And I want to give you a sense of how tough it is, because we're now 2012, and we're reading in the Wall Street Journal, should physicians use email to communicate with patients? Okay? 62% of physicians refuse to email their patients about anything. And I'm saying, this is incredible. I've been using this with patients since the mid-90s at the latest, probably before then. Well, then, and then I got this one, JAMA, leading journal, December. It said, should patients have access to their laboratory tests? Well, I'm sorry, it's their laboratory tests. Why shouldn't they have access? This is, should you have access to your office notes of your doctor? I say, wait a minute. You know, it's your visit to the doctor. Why shouldn't you have access? Just because it says SOB and it means doesn't mean that you're an SOB. It means if you're not short of breath. So, you know, you can get over that stuff. You know, you can figure that out. There's Hugo Campos, who's here in the Bay Area, and Hugo has a defibrillator. All he wants, he's on a mission to get his heart rhythm data. The poor guy, Medtronic won't give him the data. And he says, wait a minute, it's my heart, and I'm wearing this device. Why can't I get the data? It's unbelievable. And this is the last straw for me. This is the American Medical Association that's done a survey of 10,000 doctors. When they did the survey, they found that 90% have no interest in using genomics in their practice. They have no comfort. They don't have the education. They don't want to deal with it. Well, the AMA is lobbying the government hard. They have a lot of lobbying power. A lot of oomph, and this is a letter directed to the FDA commissioner, that no individual should have access to their DNA data unless it's been provided through a doctor. Okay? That's something that doesn't seem right to me. All right? Hope I can get you a little fired up about that. Hope so. So what I'm trying to leave you with is that we need these citizen scientists. They're really important. Like the family, the Beery family with the twins, the mother, who had no science background, she's the one that led the charge, led to their diagnosis, and turned that all around. And I just saw this today. This is now an amazing gaming approach to taking sequences of genomes, using gaming, and being able to have a way for non-science-grounded people to assemble a human genome. That's pretty amazing. So I just will leave you with all these you things. Okay, it's your chart, your lab test, your scan, your biosensor, your DNA, your tissue, your social network. And if we're going to go into this digitizing human beings of you, you want to have this stuff, I think. So what I'll just sum up, old medicine today. We've got this digital infrastructure, which is rich. We've got these new tools. We have this opportunity for a super convergence, the likes of which we've never seen in our history. And hopefully, with your help and our social networking power, we can override the obstacles and have a precision participatory medicine. And I hope that will leave us with a very bright future. Thanks a lot for your attention.
Our thanks to Dr. Topol for his comments here today. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with a Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to The Creative Destruction of Medicine, How the Digital Revolution Will Create a Better Healthcare, with Dr. Eric Topol. Now, we open the floor to a Q&A. I'll be passing around the microphone. If you have questions, please raise your hand and wait until you have the microphone and speak into the microphone as we are recording. Questions?
My question is, why is it so hot in here?
Well, open the door.
Okay, good.
Thank you. I'm in great agreement with most of what you said, in fact, probably all of it, especially the last few minutes. But we have a problem in America, and it's a problem that's bigger than what you've talked about. Don Berwick brought it up 20 years ago or so, and he said, there's just too much information out there that we don't use. And this is a great example of it. We also have the problem that we don't have access to basic run-of-the-mill healthcare services for a vast number of people in our population. How do you bring these things together to get over that barrier that opens the gates that allows these things to happen as part of the regular provision of healthcare in the United States?
Yeah, no, that's great. You're not Andrew Weil, are you?
No, but he looks a lot older than I do.
Okay. No, you have a little similarity in appearance. Interesting. So you're bringing up a lot of key points. So first of all, we already have a digital divide before this medical superimposition, so that's a problem. So, I mean, it's a problem much deeper than just the medical side. If we can start getting some leading-edge traction on this as a better model for healthcare, then hopefully, you know, we can also work on this problem of a digital divide that's profound in this country. But the other issue you bring up is this too much information. And I don't think so. I actually think you can't possibly get too much information if you are dealing with the information properly. What I mean is signal processing and the filtering that's vital so that you're guessing the distillate. You can't have this flood of, you know, every sensor, every minute, and all this genomic data. You have to have ways to really annotate and filter that. And that's our bottleneck right now. The bottleneck is having enough really skilled bioinformatic and computing analytical people to take that data and reduce it from TMI to highly manageable and practical information. That's where we have to go. And that, I think, is the next step. And, you know, sequencing is a commodity. Sensors are quickly going to become the commodity. It's the data that you're onto. That's the big step going forward.
All right. Next question. Anybody?
You spoke about lots of very interesting devices, but don't these devices have irradiation, like earlier X-ray and so on, somehow dangerous for your body?
Well, actually, that's a really good point you're making. We have much too much radiation, ionized radiation today. So nuclear studies and CAT scans, PET scans, these are horrific amount of radiation. And it's thought to account for 2 or 3% of cancer that we have in this country, at least. So we need to get away from that and use safe things. You know, and so, for example, if you can get a breath digitized rather than a PET scan, wouldn't that be great? If you can do alternate things that don't rely on ionized radiation, that's why I'm really keen on the ultrasound pocket device, because you can image most of the parts of the body, and there's no risk to that. This is another right of yours. When you go for a scan, do you ask how many MSVs you're getting? Do you cumulatively know how much risk? And, you know, someday you're going to know, are you genomically at risk for radiation-induced cancer? But there's no precedent today. No one has a clue how much radiation they're getting when they go sent for their scan. They just go, and, you know, in the heart world, it's the biggest offender because they just send them for a nuclear scan every year with the treadmill. And that is amazing, just in 5 years, how much radiation that is. That's 2,000 to 4,000 chest x-ray equivalents each time.
Yeah, I'll address the issue of confidentiality. I think most of us have probably had our computers hacked or our credit cards hacked. And what's to prevent people from hacking this personal information for sinister uses?
Yeah, well, you're bringing up a central issue which always comes up, which is that this is hackable and there's a potential breach of any security. And, you know, where are we going here? But the point that has to be hopefully made is that the positive is overriding this hopefully minimal risk. I mean, it has to be minimized, as you say, but you never can make it zero. We already know there's been medical centers not so far from here, like Stanford, that have had a breach of a large proportion of their electronic medical records. So once you have something digitized, that problem is created. But on the other hand, if you don't do this stuff, you don't have the upside. So there has to be that kind of balance and hopefully everything done possible to mitigate the risk. So that you always have to keep thinking about that principle, I think.
Do you, with Lipitor, do you describe... Do you give a prescription for Lipitor, or do you give alternatives to Lipitor when you have a patient?
So if someone's had heart disease, I don't have any problem with Lipitor. But if they're just taking it to lower their LDL, then I got to, each person, first of all, we need the genomics of why do they get diabetes, because then we could pinpoint it. Right now, it's just 1 in 200. We're pretty dumb. You know, we'd like to know you're the one who would get diabetes to avoid it. But the way to do it is if it's just the LDL cholesterol, and there's not much else, why not use a safe dose of simvastatin, 20 milligrams, and not be so crazy about getting this normal low LDL, which is what, unfortunately, it's really the pharmaceutical industry, that it's so much to gain, statins being the largest drug by far class, with, you know, at peak, $30 billion of sales per year. So we don't have to have our LDL cholesterol all at 60 or 70. We can back off and then have a compromise. You know, you're on simvastatin, 20 milligrams, safe, everything we know, and maybe your LDL's 110. So what? That's okay. You're still getting a good dose of a statin.
Okay. Two related things. You said 90% of the doctors are resisting use of genomic data. The second is, if the FDA is not inclined to approve some of these devices, you have like a double resistance to go through to make this come to us. I mean, is there...
Good point. That's why, and you're right on, that's why I'm relying on the consumers and the public.
Do the pull?
I think if we had the health spring, like in Egypt and Tunisia, sitting on the FDA doors, we could override this problem, okay? This is a no-brainer if we got everybody juiced up about this. But... You bring up a point. The 90% of physicians are not actively resisting this. It's more out of lack of education. Now, what are we going to do to educate physicians? That's why, you know, when I did an interview with Thomas Goetz for The Wired, talked about the Khan Academy. And I don't know if many of you saw the 60 Minutes piece Sunday night on the Khan Academy. Well, why not apply a model like that to get to all 700,000 doctors? Get them up to speed on genomics and sensors and all these things. But the problem is, you know, who's going to fund it? I can't even get Saul Khan to return an email or a phone call. So we're not working well on that. But I have gotten the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation interested, which is nice. But we need something like that. Because the way that medical education is today, it's through pharma and, you know, we can't get all the people educated without that type of mechanism, I don't think. Yeah.
I have a question in terms of side effects. In general, in terms of commercials, whenever you see a prescription, a medicine, you hear 50 different side effects. But there are actually studies in terms of what the known side effects are. And for the doctors, it would be great for the consumer to go somewhere to say, okay, these are the top ones. If you see symptoms related to that, stop taking that or come back to me for an alternative.
Right.
Is there any kind of action or sites or some kind of industry effort that's thwarting that kind of initiative, and should that be something that's sponsored by the government to do?
Well, I didn't show the slide because I already had slide overdose, I know, but there is one I have that shows the new companies that are trying to get the side effects set, teed up, like you're asking, for the public. So you don't have to look at the list of 100 things, and it has the real data that's been really put, you know, it's a lot like, you know, Thomas has worked on getting the laboratory and the reports, the same kind of thing, ready, that are patient-friendly, user-friendly. Same sort of thing has now been done by two companies, written up recently. I can get you the reference. So there is a move in that direction, because that crazy list of every side effect known to mankind is unhelpful, really. Yeah.
But we have time for only one last question.
What a privilege. regarding Tim Russert and the heart attack implant, what percentage of heart attacks involve sloughing the endothelial cells? And what is involved in the implant, and how far away from that is the how far away from the market is that product? It sounds very interesting.
Yeah, no, it's kept us really excited. All heart attacks, as we know, essentially are due. The bona fide heart attacks are due to sloughing of these cells from the lining. Yeah, so that's the problem, and they usually almost invariably occur where there's a minor narrowing. So you couldn't detect it through a treadmill stress test. So those of you who get a stress test and you get a pat on the back, everything's great. Well, that doesn't tell you if something's going to crack. Now, we're hopefully in the next year we'll have a blood test from the work that we've done, but that's not a sensor that you're implant. That's where if you go to the emergency room, this is another common story. You go to the emergency room, you're having chest pain. You go there, and they do a cardiogram, they do some blood tests, they say, oh, well, we don't see any heart attack. Then you go home, and you have a heart attack, and you come back. And the reason is because we only can pick up when there's death of heart cells by these blood tests. So we expect this blood test that we've worked on to be in that setting, but it's a one-off measurement. It's not constant surveillance. So the implant is needed to have constant surveillance in high-risk people who either had a heart attack or they're genetically at risk for heart attack. That's going to take a few years. We have done the preliminary work to get our signal, molecular signal, to a nanosensor. But we haven't yet done that, you know, to connect the dots to get that. First, we have to do, animal testing. Then we have to get to patients. It's an implant. You can imagine what the FDA will do with that. So it's going to be a little off, but we'll persevere. You know, and that one's at least 3-4 years away. The blood test, a year away. Okay.
Well, thanks to Dr. Topol for his comments here today. We also thank the audience here, as well as those listening to this recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.